interview with former Chancellor Samuel Gould of the State University of New York system at his home in Sarasota, March 23rd, 1987.
Is that on now?
It's on now.
The papers gave you some background, an interest in ultimately writing a history of the early years, the creation of Covington. I think they felt that now was not the appropriate time for it, but they learned that so many people had passed on, that Gary Schubel, who's now the provost, formerly director of marine sciences, was interested to get on tape recollections of the people who were responsible really for the development, creation and development. So I talked with Larry Murray, Harry Porter, Charlie Foster, George Dudley, and Elwin Stevens in the central office. I'm going to see Mrs. Moore when I get back. Down here, I've talked to Weisinger, who was dean of our graduate school for a while. Eisenbud, who was the first physics chairman. Harry Kalish, who was the first psychology chairman. Brad Fields, who was brought in by Tom Irvine, the dean of engineering. And before writing up the letter and the question, I put together Sidney Gilbert, Tom Irvine, Francis Bonner, former chairman of chemistry, and Cliff Ward in physics. And they talked about the early days in Oyster Bay. And when we got through, one of them said, if anybody were to write the history of Oyster Bay, nobody would believe it. I've talked with John Toll in Washington, and Ted Pellegrino has agreed to see me on the way back. I will also talk with George Collins, who was on our council and who was deputy director at Brookhaven.
Oh, yeah.
And I could talk with Maurice Goldhaber, former director, if it seems useful. I'm not quite sure that it would be. Martha Downing has suggested that I talk to a man by the name of Warren.
Jim Warren?
Jim Warren.
He used to be on the board.
Used to be on the board,
yes. He's in Albany.
Yes. I have a son in Albany, so I go up there every now and then. He's a professor at Albany.
Hopefully.
So that's the situation at the present time.
Well, you covered a great number of people, and as you mentioned them, most of them come back to me. It's been quite some time since I thought about Stony Brook in terms of the people that I was involved with, but the names all ring a bell.
And, I'd like to ask you some questions. I've got about a dozen here.
All right.
First, the situation that you walked into in the central office and with regard to the legislature and the governor. So it would go something like this.
Who appointed you? Why did you take the position? What kind of support were you promised? How did your relations with the governor and the legislature work out? The university as a state agency, relations with the Bureau of the Budget, that is Tom Hurd, I interviewed him, Axelrod, and the construction fund, etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, to start from the beginning.
All right.
As you possibly remember, I was in New York City as president of the Educational Broadcasting Corporation, having left the University of California, Santa Barbara, to take on that position. And we had got Channel 13 built and underway, and I had been at that position for about 2 years. I was considerably dissatisfied with the situation, mainly because I discovered that my only true function in the organization was to raise money. And I'm not opposed to raising money, but I had had other ideas when I took on the presidency, which were much more academically oriented, or much more socially oriented than this. And I discovered that there was little or no time for me to be involved with that. I got to see some of the plans, but I never really had a chance to participate in very much. So when an opportunity came along, this started really with discussions with Jim Allen, who was then the Commissioner of Education and a friend of mine. The position at SUNY had been open for a considerable time.
Had Tom Hamilton left,
yeah, that's right. And it was, I think, was about 2 years or so that they had been either looking or not looking. I don't know what they had been doing.
He left till December 31st of 62.
Yes, so it had been 2 years because I went there in 64.
What month do you remember?
I officially as of July 1, 64. So just under 2 years. And at that time, Frank Moore, who was chairman of the board, and Larry Murray was his assistant. I don't know what his official title was, but those two were really running the place, if I may use that term. The reputation of the university at that time was hardly one that was inviting to anyone who was interested in taking on a responsibility there. But I was greatly intrigued by the possibilities that such a system offered. I had just been in California and had had the experience of the University of California system, which was highly centralized and, as you know, excellent in its academic foundations and development. And there I had had the responsibility at Santa Barbara. I was the first chancellor there. I had had the responsibility at Santa Barbara of turning what they called a country club into an academic institution of some consequence. I took that job because that, I thought, was an exciting thing to do, and it was. It was. And although we stayed at, I speak of Laura and myself, we stayed at Santa Barbara only 3 years. They were a wonderful 3 years in terms of what I was able to do there in turning around the attitude of the campus toward learning.
Was Bob Michelson then in religion?
As what?
In religion.
Bob Michelson. The name doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
He may have been. I was the first chancellor there. They had never had a chancellor before. And this began, they were beginning to give the Santa Barbara campus some stature. There were buildings being built and things were moving. But I spent most of my time there changing the attitude of the campus, recruiting students, mainly, as well as faculty, but particularly students. I wanted students who came to Santa Barbara not to lie on the beach, but to learn.
Yes.
And we found, I went to high schools, tough schools all over the state, and asked for the opportunity to talk to their ablest students. And we attracted them there, and the result was that within 3 years, the whole place had changed considerably. It still had all the attractiveness. I don't have to describe to you what an attractive campus it was. it must be still, even though it has grown tremendously. But it's a great delight to me to see that some of the things that I started there way back in the early 60s, I was there from 59 to 62, are still part of the philosophy and the action and the activity of the institution. It has great graduate program now. It has, I guess, about 25,000 students. And I started the study abroad program, which was ultimately taken over through the whole university, and it still runs from Santa Barbara. In fact, the same man who was with me when we started it is there today, and they celebrated their 20th anniversary a year or two ago. So it was, I didn't leave Santa Barbara because I was dissatisfied, although I found that being chancellor of one campus of a large institution had certain constraints to it that were somewhat difficult for me. But basically, we had a wonderful time. But I was interested, I had been interested for a long time in radio and television. I had done some work in it. I helped build the community, the School of Communications at Boston University when I was on the faculty there, and then as assistant to the president. The idea of creating the flagship station in public television was very appealing, and as you know, the station is doing awfully well today. Well, once I had seen that my job was nothing more than fundraising, I was looking to go back into the academic world where I guess I really belonged. And so Jim Allen and I were chatting about this whole business of Albany and the fact that there was nobody in the central administration that was running the place. I thought that the notion of the chairman of the board being really, in essence, the president of the university, they called it president rather than chancellor then, and the fact that he was relying heavily on someone who was a journalist by profession and
never been to college.
And had never been to college, although he was a fine chap, and I liked him very much when I worked with him. It didn't augur well for developing the reputation of the university for the future. Well, here was a sprawling enterprise without real leadership, with no academic reputation that you could really count on, with an idea of what it wanted to do and be, but having not gone very far in that. And to me, that was sort of the only way I can describe it is to say that the only place you could go was up. And I thought that there were opportunities there, and so I agreed to go. My contacts then were entirely with Frank Moore. After I had talked with Jim Allen, and he had given me a lot of information about the place. Jim Allen, by the way, was an enormous help during the whole time I was there, until he left to do something else. You probably recall that the relationship between the Board of Regents and the State University was rather unfriendly, to put it in.
I'm afraid the legislation that Dewey was able to get through left some loose ends.
Oh, yes. And there was a tradition against public education, public higher education in the state of New York, which was a tremendous obstacle to overcome. If there were time, I could give you chapter and verse of what this meant. And it still means today, I would gather. I have an idea.
Can you be specific briefly about that? Because I think the growth of any one of the university centers
is conditioned, or was conditioned, by the general atmosphere.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right, and it is really, to me, something of a miracle that we were able to develop, ultimately, the kind of institution that Drayton University is today, particularly in the areas of graduate work that Stony Brook represents in Buffalo and Binghamton and Albany. Those university centers, which were always the target of the region, simply because the controlling higher educational elements in New York State were the large private universities who felt strongly that if there was any higher education to be provided, they could provide it, and anything else was superfluous. They looked down on the state university, and with good reason, I may say, in terms of the collection of teachers' colleges that represented the teachers' colleges at their best, always, even today, represent something that people sometimes raise their eyebrows about. In those days, it was far worse, I can assure you.
I thought of Geneseo.
Well, now Geneseo, I remember visiting Geneseo when I was the president of Antioch to give a commencement address. First time I'd seen it, a lovely little village, attractive little college. Much, of course, today it has a great deal more there than it had then. There was nothing there that made you feel that this was a great educational place. Well, that all had to be changed, and the challenge was to change it. But continuing about the relationship with the Board of Regents and the State University, I was aware that the Board of Regents had this most unusual statement, which is unique, really, not just unusual, in that it controlled every single aspect of education, and it's almost indescribable.
It's the French system. It's the University of the State of New York.
That's right. And you see, they made it more complicated by using the term the University of the State of New York, and they had a president of the University of the State of New York, and they were also the State Department of New York, the State Department of Education, and they were presumably not going to be involved ever in the creation of educational programs and the development of degrees that would be offered by them, and yet all this was happening. Some of it happened while I was there, and though I tried to fight it, we weren't strong enough then to have the kind of opportunity to hold anything like that back. For example, their entire extended education program, what I was very much interested in, non-traditional education and the opportunity for adults to study. This was developed in the department, and they wanted to get the degrees, and they developed the programs and offered the programs, which was, to me, something that they never should have been involved in the first place. I admit that I'm undoubtedly biased in feeling that way, but it seems to me that an institution of learning where there are professors, where there are faculty, where there are students regularly, and where there are programs that proceed and can be met with this, are the logical places where such things should be going on. The State Department of Education, as I always prefer to call it, was a great bureaucracy. There were over 2,000 or 3,000 people there when I was there. I don't have no idea what they're doing now. And I was anxious to see to it that ultimately the State University took its proper place in the hierarchy there. And when you had Columbia and Syracuse and NYU and Fordham and Rochester and Cornell, all cheek by jowl with the Board of Regents. Not a single kind of representation on that Board of Regents from anyone who's from the State University standpoint, from public higher education. Everyone came from those institutions or institutions like them.
Well, Dewey was the only one who was publicly educated.
That's right. And Dewey, when he started this, had a lot of political ideas in mind. I don't know whether he really was all that interested in the development of public higher education. I'm certainly willing to give him credit for everything he did, but the motives of political people are always problematical anyway, I really knew all this when I went. I wasn't disillusioned after getting there. I expected, as a matter of fact, I expected it would be even worse than it was. Interestingly enough, I tried to get the Board of Regents to be a little more receptive to the thoughts, aims, so on, of the university. And in one way, they did, almost immediately. When I first arrived, I think you'll find interesting, I came there and I spent the summer sort of going back and forth from New York. And I was there and getting used to the place, but I wasn't officially getting involved in too much. From the 1st of July until the 1st of September. And one of the first things that I learned was that we were supposed to present a 10-year master plan. It had to be repeated every 4 years, had to be revised every 4 years. And that plan was due on a date in September. And when I arrived, that plan had already been virtually drawn up by Larry. I assume it was Larry, I don't know who else could have been coming. And it was not until along about August that I really had a chance to see this. And when I read it, I thought to myself, this is wrong, it is not the master plan for this university. It is not what I want to see happen here, and I'm going to do everything I can to get this thing on track right off. I had a lot more, I think it maybe was out of ignorance or whatever else, but I had, I suppose some people would say it was over-aggressiveness, but it was the only way I knew in which to get anything changed there. And so I determined right then and there that we would write a new master plan. That plan was due to the Board of Regents, to the governor, to the legislature by, I think it was the 19th of September of that month. I may have the wrong date, but it was not very far away. Well, this is one time when I managed to win something. I think probably I got a little outside help in it because I went to the governor and I explained that I was not pleased with the master plan as it stood, that I felt it didn't represent what we really wanted to have happen, and I asked for an extension of time to rewrite the master plan. I think it was 60 days I asked for. And the governor agreed.
Well, I went to Rockefeller.
This was Rockefeller. Incidentally, Rockefeller had absolutely nothing to do with my coming. I had never met him until after I had been appointed. And my friend's opinion at the time was that they were so desperate after 2 years but have not having, you know, they had been turned down by all sorts of people, I'm sure. And they had come to the point where they were throwing up their hands and therefore Frank Moore, he told me later, one of the things that really moved him in nominating me to the board and pushing for my selection was that in all our conversations, I did meet with members of the board, naturally, before this thing came to an end. The thing that moved him most was that I never mentioned anything about my own personal relationship to this job. I didn't ask him about his salary. I didn't ask him about the house he lived in. I didn't ask him about anything. But all I talked about was what had to be done in the institution to make it an institution of first rank. He said, everybody else that I talked to wanted to know how much money do we get, what kind of a house am I going to live in, do I get a car, do I get a driver, do I get this, do I get that. And I never mentioned any of them. Somewhat stupidly, probably, but this time I never mentioned.
So that gives some idea of your priorities.
But it's true, and it's been true all my life, as a matter of fact. I have it's caused a certain amount of suffering for me that I never planned for my own future. To be able to plan for institution's future, I had that happen at Antioch and at Santa Barbara and here and in everything else that I've done. Anyway, Rockefeller gave me permission. But he said the others will have to agree too. I went to the majority leader in the Senate. I went to the Speaker of the House. I'm trying to remember their names and don't. The Speaker of the House is an Italian. It's an Italian name.
Jordan Carino?
That doesn't sound right.
Okay.
I can't remember. Anyway, I went to those and asked them for that permission, and they, not enthusiastically, but they reluctantly granted it. And I went to the Legion, to Jim Allen, and made my request. And by that time, I had the others agreeing, and they went along. And I got that extra time. I took two members of the staff. One was Jim Frost. These are people who were there. I hadn't had an opportunity to hire anybody or do anything. Jim Frost and an assistant that I had named Thomas. I think it's his first name. Bob Thomas. We met at, we moved into the house up on Marion Avenue in Austin about the 5th of September. And from September 1st until September 19th, or whatever that date was, on the added semester, they came, we worked sometimes during the day, but we worked every night, putting that thing together until 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And we finished this master plan, which was submitted and accepted. And it was the first master plan, and the major features of it, which I never deviated from during the entire time I was at, the entire 6 years that I spent at Harvard, could be identified in three words. The first was identity. The second is unity, and the third is equity. And everything we did pointed to these three things. We had to make sure, first of all, well, they had to be done simultaneously, but we had to make sure that we were recognized as an institution, that people knew who we were. We had to be unified as a university. And one of the things that has troubled me since is that they now talk of it as a university system. To me, it is never a university system. It is a university. It may have many parts all over the place, but those parts must be so arranged that they have business to do with one another. And they have opportunities to give and to take from one another, whether it be library facilities, whether it be ideas, whatever. And we tried to do that thing, and we succeeded. The University Senate, which has been a very moribund institution, I don't know what they did, but apparently it was very little, reorganized into an active institution that met with me 3 or 4 times a year for a whole day, and the faculty had a chance to hear all the plans and all the progress that was going on within the university. There was an interaction that caused people to begin to believe that this was indeed a university and not just a collection of institutions spread out all over the state. And the same thing was true in terms of the students. This, incidentally, was Ernie Boyer's major function when I brought him from California to arrange for the kinds of things that showed everybody that this was a university, a unified university. The students used to have weekends when they came from different campuses and they presented plays at the single campus for the weekend, or another time it was a